You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome in hour two of the Mike Allen Show here on this Friday, November 11th, Veterans Day, feast day of St. Martin of Tours. A great day indeed, great day as every day is to be a Catholic Christian. Looking forward to my guest at the bottom of the hour. He is Timothy Stanley, who is a British author, journalist, historian. He has been on the program before, really appreciate his perspective on things, not just his perspective from a distance. Sometimes we struggle living in the midst of this country and as citizens to see the forest for the trees, proverbially speaking. But he also has the perspective of a historian and a fresh on the shock of the Brexit vote in Great Britain, which he had many comments about. And there's some, I think, parallels between the Brexit vote and the Trump vote. Sort of the rise of populism, so to speak. So we'll ask him about his perspective because he, for the last week of the Trump campaign, actually followed Trump's campaign around. He was there at the Trump campaign's victory party. And in fact, I posted a link to his article in today's Daily Telegraph from London. We'll get his perspective at the bottom of the hour. Should be fun. Some other things we'll talk about today is we'll look at today's gospel reading a little bit more. We'll talk about how elitism has many faces and also the overlooked downside of what we might call post-election civility. Certainly welcome your calls. This week is the 26th anniversary of the premiere of the film Home Alone, and sort of marking the I think it was in 1990, so the end of quite an incredible decade for the filmmaker John Hughes. And so I'm asking the question of the day, what is your favorite John Hughes film? 573-4-BREAD-4. Maybe it is Home Alone. 573-4-BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a response on Facebook or on Twitter. As I shared earlier from Newsday.com, their ranking of the top 10 John Hughes films. And I'm looking at them, like number one, they had The Breakfast Club, kind of a no-brainer. Number two, a little bit of a surprise, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which is a movie I love. Number three, Mr. Mom, 83, Pretty in Pink. Number four, 1986. I'm just looking to see if maybe Home Alone represented in many ways sort of the end of the John Hughes era in which he was so dominant. 16 Candles, 1984, Ferris Bueller, 86, National Lampoon's Vacation, 83, Home Alone, 90, Weird Science, 85, and Some Kind of Wonderful, 87. So all these films, except for Home Alone, which just into the 1990s were 1980s stalwarts. So, man, what a decade. And don't know what he's made since then, but I need to check that out. But your favorite John Hughes film, if you want to chime in, as I said, 573-4-BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a thought on Facebook or on Twitter. Back to the gospel reading for today on this feast day of St. Martin of Tours, taken from the gospel of Jesus. As I said, we're getting near the end of the liturgical year. The Feast of Christ the King is a week from Sunday, and you begin to see in the readings, not just in the Sunday readings, but even in the daily readings, we begin to drift into some of, in the Gospels particularly, the sort of apocalyptic teachings of Jesus, the signs that will accompany the end of the age, because again, every liturgical year is almost like a life. It begins with the advent and the birth of Christ, and of course culminates with the Feast of Christ the King, when he will return and make his kingship clear in a way different than his kingship was revealed in a manger in Bethlehem. In today's passage, Jesus saying that the days of the Son of Man will be like the days of Noah. And they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage up to the day Noah entered the ark and so forth. I was talking a little bit about Noah and the ark last night. And as I mentioned before, you know, it's one of those stories that, you know, there are a lot of biblical stories that if you stopped, did one of those, you know, Jimmy Kimmel, man on the street interviews, you'd be embarrassed at the lack of biblical knowledge in our culture. But at least the Noah story, I think if you interviewed 100 people on the street, my guess is they just about all know the basic premise or story behind it. Most of them maybe heard it as a child. And as I've said before, it's an odd children's story when you think about it, because 99.9% of the people on earth die in quite a horrific fashion. So, you know, it's the stuff of children's wallpaper and all the rest. But it is a compelling sort of story in many ways, right? I mean, it's got its own particular, elements in it that, like I said, most people are well aware of. But the thing about the story, we were talking about this a little bit last night, Jesus refers to it. Before we dismiss it, which a lot of people are prone to do, we do need to remember that Jesus talked about the Noah account, not simply as an event that happened in history, that there was some sort of cataclysmic flood, there was a man named Noah, but also this understanding that it served as a sign in many ways for us. Of course, in the early church, they began to see the flood as a type, a foreshadowing of sorts of baptism. This is why you hear readings regarding the flood around the Easter Vigil or the blessing of the baptismal water or in the baptismal rite, because just as water washed away the evil from the earth that the Lord saw where the wickedness of human hearts were prone and bent toward evil, water was a new creation. It's really what it was. And it's interesting, you see the parallels between the first creation at the beginning of Genesis and the new creation that comes from Noah. And just as the Lord told the original couple to be fruitful and multiply, when Noah and his family leave the ark, they're told to be fruitful and multiply. I mean, there are multiple parallels between the two. And so the early church saw baptism as having that same impact, the waters of baptism washing away the evil within our own souls. And then they also began to see the ark itself as a type of the church. And as I was saying in this Bible study that I was leading last night, the ark as a church is easy to understand, particularly when you think how bad it must have stunk at times inside Noah's vessel with all the animals. We can only imagine the wheelbarrows full of manure that had to be dealt with in some way. And man, you ever smell a wet dog? But as we say, the stink on the inside sure as heck beat what was going on outside. Church is much the same way. Believe me, we look around at the flaws, the annoyances, the things within the church, things we wish were better. But let me tell you, being inside sure beats what's outside. Now, Jesus uses the Noah account here in a little bit of a different way as a foreshadowing of what it will be on the day the Son of Man returns. And that we need to be very mindful that we don't ignore the signs, as monotonous as they may become. And I remember back in the days of being a Methodist pastor, preaching a sermon on this very passage. And I kind of started the sermon for about 10 seconds. I just pounded on the pulpit. And that alone, just like something like this. Just like that, right? And I kind of got everybody's attention, those folks who were used to sleeping during my sermons. Only a few. They were really tired. It wasn't that I was boring, surely. Anyway, but I did that, and I was kind of making the point that we have the ability over time. You know, at first we find something like that really annoying, but we have the ability over time to tune it out. You know, I've talked often about my my car, which is well past its expiration date, my 1999 Pontiac Bonneville. Still gets me around, embarrasses my children, but it gets me around. But it's got something going on with it, and I guess I can get it checked out. But there's some kind of a indication light that beeps. A lot of the time, you're driving around, and it's beep, 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 beep. And I've kind of gotten to the point where I'm used to it. Somebody gets in the car with me, it's very annoying, but I've tuned it out. We do that. We do that with alarms. Find ourselves sleeping through our alarm because that what would have been an annoying sound becomes something we hear all the time. This is what Jesus says, in essence, was happening. You know, if you read the biblical account, of course, and we're not sure how literally to take every aspect of the account, but Noah was working on this boat for over 100 years. That's a long project. You thought government was slow. 120 years, people heard this pounding. Not a drop of rain, but here's a guy building a boat. And they tuned it out. They did. And then the flood came. There are signs all around us, have been for a long time, that this earth as we know it is passing. If not the end of human history, our own end of human history. And we need to have our hearts prepared, not out of fear, but out of love, as the bridesmaids, the virgins with their lamps lit. That's the kind of thing we're talking about. We'll talk on the other side of the break a little bit more about the election. At the bottom of the hour, I'm going to have my friend Tim Stanley on, but I want to talk about the many faces of elitism. There's been a lot of talk about elitism with the results of this election Tuesday night. I don't know that we consider them all. So we'll talk about it when we come back for the break. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this feast day of St. Martin of Tours, also Veterans Day. Thanks again to all you veterans who have served so faithfully, and those living and dead, defending and the cause of freedom in the world and for the privileges that we enjoy, for those who are currently serving and stationed, and for the families who are impacted, we give you thanks on this day and hopefully every day. 5734BREAD4 if you want to chime in or comment on my question of the day, which is, what's your favorite John Hughes film? John Hughes, whose heyday was in the 80s, but probably his last really, really big hit was Home Alone, which came out in 1990, 26 years ago, actually yesterday. So when you think about John Hughes, what's the film that comes to mind that you especially appreciate? I know I've gotten a couple comments on this on Facebook. Let me see if I can pull it up. Shannon says, I believe he's responsible for Breakfast Club, and so that would be my favorite John Hughes film. Chelsea, who's on our program monthly, she said, ah, tough one, but I'm going to have to go with 16 Candles, followed closely by Weird Science and Vacation/Christmas Vacation, which is one of my all-time favorites in general. It's one of those movies I'll stop and watch no matter how many times I come across it on TV. Hilarious and never gets old. Yeah, that was Molly Ringwald, Anthony Michael Hall, John and Joan Cusack, one of their first films. Really, really good indeed. So chime in, 5734BREAD4, email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. If you want to learn more about what we do at Breadbox Media, particularly if you're curious about this idea of your Catholic parish having its own stream, so that you get the same programming, the same contributors who contribute daily shows, weekend shows from all around the country, every corner of the continent, as well as through across the heartland. You can go to breadboxmedia.com. You can check out all those different shows, podcasts, and so forth. Get the app for your digital device. But if you get a pair of Stream, then you get some of the great programming accompanying us together toward Christ and toward the church he founded, the beauty and the comprehensive integrity of the Catholic faith. But you get those 3-minute commercial breaks to do with what you want. You can have advertisers from within the parish, and parish can even get half the revenue from that. You could have messages. It can be a communication hub, all sorts of things. So check it all out, breadboxmedia.com, as well as how to be a friend of your favorite show. It's really been a remarkable 48 hours or so, if you think about it. I guess now we're maybe up closer to, you know, whatever, 60 hours. A remarkable turn of events on so many levels with this election. And we're going to have Timothy Stanley on at the bottom of the hour to talk about it. I've told you that I could not support either major party candidate and still have profound concerns going forward. As I told somebody, my reaction Tuesday night as the thing unfolded was, on one level, I'm not going to lie to you, it was like, yes, Hillary Clinton lost her pro-abortion agenda and anti-religious freedom agenda and corruption and all the rest. But then my very second thought was, after, yes, Hillary lost, was, oh no, we've elected Trump. And I'm not sure which reaction was the strongest. And so we'll see where we go from here. Certainly so far in the last few days, what we've seen out of Donald Trump in terms of demeanor and so forth has been better. Still a long way to go. I mean, my concern has been that we've taken someone who has strong, at the very least, narcissistic tendencies, and we validated him. So we'll see. Well, we'll try to follow our president's advice and give him the benefit of the doubt. But even, and I'll talk about this toward the end of the program, even the civility that has marked what happened since the election raises its own questions for me. But I'll get into that. One of the remarkable things I was talking about yesterday is the last whatever 2.5 days has done in terms of the perceived futures of each of the two major parties. I mean, on Tuesday, the Democratic Party was ascendant. I mean, people did not, I mean, what was it, Nate Silver of 538.com gave Hillary a 78% chance of winning the presidency. I think the vast majority of pundits believed that she would win the presidency and held out the possibility that her coattails would lead to the Democrats retaking the Senate away from the Republicans. Probably wouldn't take the House. That would be a little bit, you know, that would be a little bit too much to expect, but certainly the Senate. And they were having visions, I'm sure, of 8 years of Hillary Clinton, and then who knows, maybe 8 years of Michelle Obama. We don't know. I mean, the idea was, as the Republican Party has collapsed in on itself by nominating Donald Trump, it's over for the Republicans. The future is the Democratic Party, and the Republicans are going to be left scrambling. And yet then just a few hours later, it's exactly the opposite. Now, you have to be careful here, right? Because it's amazing how, you know, it's kind of like winning a basketball game when the winning shot from the other team rims out at the buzzer. Yes, you're the champions, but it's amazing how what a thin line there is between joy and despair. And we're seeing that, right? Because these margins were small in these states, and yet Trump won. And so now, not only did he win, the Senate remains Republican, and the House, all three branches of government at a federal level. You had movements here in the state of Kentucky that the House went Republican for the first time in I don't know how long. It was in a monumental shift. And now the Democrats are scrambling, wondering if there's a future for them, seeing themselves as out of touch and so forth. And people are wondering what the Republicans are going to do now with all this power. It's really quite stunning to just purely from an academic, detached sort of perspective. But here's the thing that I've been thinking about as well. You know, there's been a lot of talk about elitism in this election and how the shock at a Trump victory has exposed the sense of detachment that many in the mainstream media and party apparatus in the Democratic Party and others have from Middle America. You know, it's interesting. You look at an electoral map. I think it's a mistake now to only look at red state, blue state. I think you look at city urban, I mean, urban country. And you look at a map and you see the vast swaths of red rural America and the little pockets of blue urban America. This is why there are those on the left now clamoring for an end of the Electoral College. But the Electoral College was designed precisely to accomplish what it did Tuesday, to not let the more highly densely populated areas dominate the rest of the country. And that's part of what happened. But there's been a lot of talk. There's been, I think, some smugness from those on the right about how out of touch the Dems are and so forth. But here's the thing that you see, right, from the right as well. There's elitism can cut both ways. There's a smugness on the right, and I see this even among Catholics and evangelicals, and it really bothers me, a smugness toward those who are distressed by the election of Trump. And I think, you know, here's the thing. I keep hearing this phrase, right? It's catchy and has a certain degree of truth, right? Trump's critics took him literally but not seriously. And then I hear it from the Trump supporters that I know. But Trump supporters took him seriously but not literally, which is, quite frankly, a little bit of a disconnect from what we heard during the campaign. Those who supported Trump did so because he spoke the unvarnished truth. He wasn't afraid. There was no spin. Now we're being told, no, don't take him quite so literally. Take him seriously, but not literally. But here's my concern. I think there is a certain pocket of Trump supporters who took him quite literally and take him quite literally. And I think that fuels the concern on those who are most distressed about an ascendant Trump. People of color, immigrant populations, particularly those from the South, those who are undocumented, and as I've told you before, are here for reasons that probably would have prompted any of us to cross over national borders, to be quite honest with you. Muslim Americans. And now there's this fear, and I've seen it even among immigrants who are citizens, that their brown skin is going to cause problems for them among people who took Trump quite literally. It's easy. Here's where the elitism kicks in, I think. It's easy for those who voted Trump for some other reason, his alleged pro-life positions, or because they hated Hillary Clinton. Easy for us of those, quite honestly, who are in positions of relative security to look askance and to roll our eyes at the victimhood of those who are troubled by a Trump presidency. That's a different kind of elitism, but it is an elitism nonetheless. People who are afraid of a Trump presidency have reason to be. It's not crazy or irrational. And if we think it is, it's because, quite frankly, we don't live where they live. More on that later. I'm asked Tim Stanley about that too when we come back for the break. This is the Mike Allen Show. We'll be back in just a minute with British author, historian Timothy Stanley. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
We're right at the bottom of the hour. Here on this Friday, November 11th, Veterans Day, also feast day of St. Martin of Tours. Of course, it's been a big week, and certainly on the political scene, and been blessed to be able to catch up here with Timothy Stanley. Tim is an English blogger, journalist, and historian. Does great work. You can read his writing in The Telegraph. He's been in the Catholic Herald. He's certainly been both in print and on video with CNN, and we're pleased to have him. He's been following the Trump campaign around. And Timothy, good morning.
Good morning to you. Hello.
What are you in D.C.? Is that where you currently are?
I'm currently in Washington, D.C., yes.
Wow. And here for the time being until you're called back, evidently.
I was supposed to go home the day after the election, but the newspaper said stay there. What's interesting is that if Hillary Clinton had won, I would have gone home because no one would have cared and life would have continued as normal. But because Trump won, that's newsworthy enough to keep me here. So that tells you what Europe thinks about the election.
I can't help, you know, a lot of people have made the parallels in terms of shocking election results, comparing Trump's victory with the Brexit vote in your native England. Maybe compare, contrast the two.
It's actually not the first surprise election result that I've covered as a journalist. I also covered the British general election in 2015, when again, polls suggested that the left-wing Labour Party was going to be able to form a government. And instead, the Tories won quite handily. Then we had Brexit, where again, we were told that Remain, the side that wanted to stay in the EU, was going to win and probably win quite easily. I'd personally predicted that they would win something like 60-40. In the end, they ended up winning about 52-48. Leave won 52-48. It was a huge surprise. It seems that polling is either bad, or people are lying to pollsters, or the wrong people are being sampled. It's difficult to tell exactly why polling has gotten it so wrong in the last couple of years. But my suspicion is that we are witnessing a social and political change taking place across the Western world. And polling hasn't quite caught up, that people are using models and using the wrong models, speaking to the wrong people. And they're failing to capture something subtle but big. A huge global change of mind and opinion. And this election has confirmed it. And I, for one, will never trust polls again. And instead, I promise that I will now actually base my predictions upon what I actually personally see. And I saw the enthusiasm at the Trump rallies, but I still convinced myself, because the polls said that the rest of the states didn't want it, I still convinced myself that it didn't count for anything. But it turns out, actually, that kind of grassroots enthusiasm matters.
And how would you, I mean, if you had to sum up what this social upheaval or what this movement is about that's across continents even, what would you say? What are the common threads?
And they're all about identity. It's a revolution in identity. Since the 1990s, we have bought into a model not just of global capitalism, but also of social liberalism. And the idea that nation states matter less, that gender matters less, that class matters less, and that where you're born and your country and even your ethnicity matters less. And I think that was in part accurate. I think many of those things did change and fade away. But also it was that's an ideology which has been framed by certain interest groups and encouraged and has become an orthodoxy. And that's changed. It turns out that people faced with the credit crunch, faced with the economic crisis the last few years, faced with the Iraq war, people have gone back to identity, back to gender, religion, ethnicity. All these things are really important again. And that's why the liberal media, liberal politicians, liberal businessmen are slightly behind the rest of the world, because they're really talking a completely different language from ordinary people who are reasserting their sense of identity. I think that's what happened in Brexit, and that's what's happened with Trump. People have said, you know what, I'm American, I'm conservative, I'm religious, whatever, and I don't like the current social order, and they rebelled against it.
Now, you're a historian. That's not my wheelhouse, but I'm familiar with, I guess, a point of view that has maybe fallen out of favor, the great man theory, you know, of history. How would you lay that grid over this Trump election? I mean, was Trump simply the circumstance that gave voice to this movement, and it really could have been anybody, or is it in a sense both and?
It's both and. The movement was taking place without him. The world was shifting to the right as it was. Again, it's rather surprising that people factored this out, but people forget that in 2014, the Republicans did very well in the midterm elections. And also, the election was partly just a rational response to Obama's failures. So in a sense, the country was going to move to the right anyway. But I do think that Trump rewrote the rules of how you run a presidential campaign. It required someone with his degree of shamelessness to win the primaries on this kind of identity platform. And then it required someone with his degree of shamelessness to take on the Clinton machine and win the general election. He did things that no other Republican candidate would do, such as calling Hillary Clinton directly to her face a liar and saying that her husband was an abuser of women and saying that he would lock her up and saying that if he won, she'd be in jail. These are things no Republican would do, but actually they're things that ordinary Americans all think. For too long, politics has operated in this very polite, refined way of people skirting around what people really think. The genius of Donald Trump was simply to say what people think. And, you know, a lot of the time you don't want leaders who say what people think because people do sometimes think dumb things. But in this instance, Hillary Clinton was an exhausted political figure. She should have dropped out of electoral politics 8 years ago. But she kept on going, in part because politicians gave her a free pass. And Trump, in essence, said to her, "Why are you still here? Why are you still in the game?" And no one else would have said that. And that's one of the reasons why he won.
It's, I was talking with some friends yesterday. What an amazing 2 or 3 days in terms of what was expected, not just in this election, but there was a sense in which this was the age of the Democrats. I mean, they were going to have the White House. They were going to have possibly the Senate. The Republican Party was in disarray because of all the divisions. And the Republican Party, how are they going to even still have a place at the table? And now the Democrats have none of them. And there are open questions about their future. And the Republican Party seems ascendant.
Yes. Here's the other thing that we got wrong. As well as missing the rise of the right wing, we also overestimated the power of the left. The left in the last 10 years built a coalition of young people, women, gays, blacks, Latinos. And because they were demographically growing in the population, we assumed that that coalition was unbeatable and that that coalition was what had put Obama in the White House. Looking at the results that we've been looking at for the last couple of days, it looks like actually the outlier was Barack Obama. People voted for Barack Obama because they liked Barack Obama, not because they were liberal or because they were part of this coalition. Once you took Barack Obama off the ballot, the coalition just faded away. And about 6-7 million Democrats just didn't come to the polls. That's really what won this election turnout. Conservatives did turn up, liberals didn't. So we're going to have to rethink that. That liberal coalition, it turns out, is not indomitable. It's not inevitable, and it can be beaten. And in fact, all along, really, it was about Barack Obama. It wasn't about the left. The left is not popular, and I would not want to be a left-wing retail politician right now because you've got a real struggle on your hands.
Yeah, as bad as this election was for the Democrats and for Hillary Clinton, I mean, even worse, really, for the president. I mean, in terms of his legacy, because in many ways it was a repudiation.
It absolutely was. And one of the sleeper issues which got minimal coverage was Obamacare. And I felt that as soon as I arrived in the country, and particularly I felt it in the last week when the Obamacare hikes kicked in, when the cost of premiums suddenly shot up for some people. You know, in Arizona, the cost of Obamacare premiums doubled. I'm surprised this was underreported. It was underreported because people were focusing on the email scandal. They were focusing on Trump's issues with women, things like that. But actually, It turns out Obamacare, not popular with most voters, popular with the people who've been given insurance for the first time, not popular for people who've had to pick up the costs of other people being given insurance by having their premiums go up in order to pay for the long-term conditions of other people. So, again, this is partly about identity, but this is also partly about a rational response to the last 8 years. Barack Obama decided to throw everything into Clinton and to help turn the election into a referendum on him. He framed it that way, too. He got Clinton to say this was about protecting his legacy. That's how they thought they would get blacks and Latinos and women out to the polls. That was a huge risk on his part, and it backfired. He helped turn this into a referendum on him, and he lost that referendum. Mm.
So, Tim, are you able to hold on for a few minutes on the other side of the break?
Yes, of course.
Oh,
yeah.
Fantastic, because I really want to continue this conversation. I want to get you to help me where I need help about my concerns regarding the future, because you've written, you know, you've given me some hope about the future of the Trump presidency. So we'll talk about this other break. Back with Tim Stanley, British author, historian, journalist, here on The Mike Allen Show. If you've got a question, 573-4BREAD-4. We'll be back in just a minute. This is Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Friday, November 11th, here with Tim Stanley, who is a British author, journalist, historian, lead writer for the Daily Telegraph, CNN Opinion, and contributing editor for the Catholic Herald. We're talking about the surprising Trump victory. Tim Stanley followed Mr. Trump around in the last several days of his campaign. Must have been a pretty whirlwind tour.
It was. Although, actually, I stuck to the East Coast. I just did North Carolina and Pennsylvania and Virginia. I actually managed to limit it to just a few states.
Yeah, I saw some of your pictures on Twitter. Got to see some interesting sights. The Harper's Ferry, for example.
That's right. Yes, I was. My friend very kindly agreed to actually drive me up to Pittsburgh, and we went up through Maryland and West Pennsylvania, somewhere I've never seen, some of the most beautiful countryside in the world.
We got a question here from a listener. She writes, if this vote was a referendum on Obama, if you look at popular vote, Clinton won. Does this mean that the nation as a whole favors democratic liberal principles and the job that Obama did? Isn't this something that Trump must consider when taking actions on policies he has promised, such as Obamacare?
That's a very, very good point. And something that tends to get forgotten, that Clinton did actually win the popular vote. Of course, constitutionally, it doesn't matter. What matters is that you carry as many states rather than as many people as possible, because this is a union of states rather than a popular democracy. But having said that, that is a very good point. The way I would answer that is, given everything Trump was up against, to win even without quite winning the popular vote is a landslide. It's the same with Brexit. Although Brexit actually only won by a couple of percentage points, because it was up against the entire weight of global opinion, British opinion, economics, et cetera, because it won at all, that was treated as a landslide victory. So I think you have to contextualize his win. And given what he's up against, I think you have to accept that it does signify something going on. But no, the country is, of course, divided in two. Of course, it's divided into, but it's just that we thought up until now that the liberal coalition was much bigger than the conservative reaction, and we were wrong.
Talk about your experience at the, you wrote about it in the Telegraph, and I posted a link to it on the show's Facebook page and on Twitter, your night at the Trump victory party. That must have been quite, was there a very palpable shift in mood that happened over the course of the first few hours?
Oh, absolutely. We in the press thought we'd be going to bed at midnight. We assumed that the election would be over by about 10, there'd be a concession by about 11, and that we could all then go home. And then I was supposed to get on a plane the next day. So the press were in a pretty good mood. The Trump people were in a pretty bad mood because they thought they were losing, right? Because that's what the exit polls were suggesting. And the first few exit polls that came out showed women voting by big numbers, and they showed Clinton heading towards an easy win. So the mood was very, very poor. There were also very few people there, and they were quite an eclectic and strange mix of people. It was a mix of wealthy New York socialite women in evening wear and teenage boys in caps and blazers and greased hair trying to look like Trump. It was just, it reminded me of a wedding party. It didn't feel like a political party. But then suddenly Florida was very close. And then he started to pick up votes in Michigan and Pennsylvania. The ballroom filled up. The energy was fantastic. They were absolutely over the moon. The Trump people, as far as they were concerned, they had won. They were thrilled. The press people, by contrast, were really dispirited and depressed. I mean, you know, 90% of the people in the press room, I would assume, voted Hillary Clinton. And there was, between us, running around the sides of the room was a metal barrier to keep the press from the delegates. And the Trump people were actually quite, they were quite reluctant to let us speak to the party people. And it just created this extraordinary literal and figurative divide between the press and the people. We were all penned in, depressed. And then just over the other side of the metal barrier were all the people who were thrilled. And that to me said so much about this election and why the reporting on it went wrong, that reporters were just so instinctively opposed to Trump that they couldn't see the victory coming. Mm. And then when it did come, he emerged at the balcony and walked around the side of the room and down towards the podium. It was remarkable. I'd never felt anything like it. It's unlike any election I've ever known. A real feeling that regardless of the man and what you think about the man, that this is real history in the sense that it actually changes something the way a Romney victory wouldn't have done. And to be there and witness that was incredible.
You know, we talked a little bit off air. I told you, you know, and we talked on the program before about how I, as a Catholic, I could not bring myself to a place in my conscience where I could vote for either candidate. I mean, I certainly opposed Hillary Clinton and particularly her, you know, her pro-abortion agenda, which is the strongest of any candidate probably in American history. Certainly concerns about religious freedom, Supreme Court. But Trump, in my view, had been such a moral disaster on so many levels, tapped into and fomented such ugly nativist strains and misogynistic stuff. I just couldn't bring myself to vote for him. So my reaction when the thing unfolded at first was, yes, Hillary lost. Then it was, oh no, we've elected Trump. I've tried to get some friends to help me not be too despondent, because my concern is not so much for the man himself, but I think he's a showman in many ways. My concern is that he's tapped into things, you know, ugly strains of scapegoating and nativism that he will not have the power to control. And for people that I know who are immigrants, you know, people that I know who are of color, I think their fears are real and I don't think they're irrational.
Yeah, I agree with that. A lot of people will have voted for Trump because they're racists or they're misogynists, in the same way that a lot of people voted for Brexit because they don't like foreigners. And I supported Brexit. And rationalizing that to yourself is very difficult. It does test your conscience. I'd be a moral simpleton if I didn't think if I wasn't concerned about the fact that I argued for something that racists support. Likewise, there's no denying that there are members of the Ku Klux Klan or former Grand Wizards who support Trump. There are dreadful misogynists who support Trump. And I understand people's concerns. All I would say is that, first of all, the moment you stop being a candidate and you become the president, there's a kind of a magical spell that's cast. And that was obvious at the White House yesterday. I went and covered Trump's first meeting with Obama. And just something about being in the White House changes the way people behave and the way they think about themselves. And you can visibly see that Trump has already graduated from a rebel outsider to President of the United States. And that's going to mean that he changes his tone. I also hope that some of that hypocrisy in Trump becomes apparent, because we were told that whatever he might say publicly, he's actually very good at hiring women. He's actually not a racist. I hope that we see some of that, and he's got to articulate that. And I also hope there are people around him who recognize that some of the things he said were unacceptable, and he's got to strike a new tone. I think people like Paul Ryan are really important now to help shape the moral direction of the presidency. So I'm not saying everything's going to be fine. I'm right now encouraging people to chill out and calm down and relax, because I'm hoping that we're going to see the evolution from Donald Trump candidate to Donald Trump the president, and that that will necessitate a change in the way that he does things. He's never going to stop being Donald Trump. All the ethics stuff doesn't go away. In fact, I believe he'll be going to court pretty soon, because the Trump University lawsuits are still ongoing. So all that stuff isn't going to go away. But we just have to hope that he now acts in a presidential manner and that he governs for all Americans.
What do you think the international reaction is going to be? I mean, we've talked before about how, you know, President Bush was perceived, particularly in Europe, how President Obama was viewed. I mean, is this seen as a joke, or do people take Trump seriously?
They take Trump seriously, and the international reaction has been hysterical, and something I will spend the next few weeks doing in Britain when I get back is, again, telling people to calm down and telling one or two people to shut up, because there have been some headlines and some articles and some TV documentaries which are so hysterical that they're irresponsible. I was outraged by a headline in the Daily Mirror, which is a very popular tabloid newspaper in Britain, which said, "Trump wins, experts predict World War III." And I think that's outrageous, because there are people reading this who genuinely are worried. There are kids who read these headlines too, who are asking questions about it. And I think to stoke those kinds of fears is going to add to the kind of social tensions that we've clearly got across the Western world. And I wish that some newspaper editors would just calm down and look at this rationally, and remember some of those things that I've said, and also remember how the American Constitution works, that his powers will be divided, that he'll be scrutinized by the media, by the Democrats, by his own party. But unfortunately, right now, the world has hit the panic button.
Sure. Well, we're about out of time. It's always enjoy talking to you, Tim. I really appreciate you taking time. I know, and I'll look forward to continuing to follow your coverage of this development. Blessings to you and your ongoing work.
Thank you very much. Have a good weekend.
You too, as well. And we'll be back Monday by God's grace. Have a great rest of your day. Again, to all you veterans out there, those who have served, for families, for those who are now in harm's way, our prayers are with you. St. Martin of Tours, pray for us. This is Breadbox Media, and you've been listening to The Mike Allen Show.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.